This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight...
The signs are there that if certain things don't happen right, it can trigger violence, and it doesn't take much. It's a little spark, and something terrible could happen. So many people are concerned about that.
That's VOA's Vincent Macori in Nairobi on the latest ahead of Kenya's elections. Details coming up. Also, outrage against the nomination of Zimbabwe's president as a World Health Organization Goodwill Ambassador has led to his swift removal. And 13 people have been killed by a suicide bombing in the northeastern Nigerian town of Maiduguri. We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, with just 3 days before Kenya holds a rerun of its August elections, tensions are rising. Opposition leader Raila Odinga says the elections will not be held and his followers have called more protests. President Uhuru Kenyatta's Jubilee Party insists the vote will go ahead and promises to ensure the safety of all who vote. Our colleague Vincent Macori is in Nairobi and spoke with Kate Pound-Dawson on the situation.
We have those two hardline positions. But at the same time, in the middle of this, is the Electoral Commission. The Electoral Commission chairman, Mr. Wafula Chebukati, is holding a meeting today with his returning officers from across the country. And what they're trying to determine is whether they will be able, in fact, to conduct elections in certain parts of this country on Thursday, depending on the conditions on the ground, because the law provides that the Electoral Commission can, on determining that the conditions are not right to conduct a free and fair election, they can actually suspend elections in those particular areas.
Is there a chance they might go ahead and suspend and then hold the vote at a later date in those areas?
That is what the rules provide, that they can actually suspend the vote, but then that vote has to take place within about 7 days in the same areas, and therefore the total vote counting will have to be suspended until votes are cast in those particular areas. So we are waiting to see what the chairman says after the closed-door meeting. But there's also something else here. There are concerns that perhaps the chairman of the electoral body could, if he does feel that he cannot conduct a proper election and that the principals involved here, that is the president of the country, the leader of the ruling coalition, and the opposition leader, Raila Odinga, refuse to come and hold a dialogue with him to figure out the best way forward. If he does strongly feel that under those conditions he cannot deliver the kind of results that will be acceptable, he could quit. Essentially, he could step down. That leaves the country in a state of confusion because under the Constitution right now, only the chairman can declare the president. And without him, right now, if he quit, the elections will effectively be cancelled until they go through a process of getting another chairman for the Electoral Commission.
Both the UN and AU have issued calls for peace ahead of the election. And I understand that the Jubilee Coalition is also calling for restraint. Are there genuine fears of violence?
Yes, there are genuine fears of violence. Both sides have followers who are very, very animated. In fact, the positions that have been taken by the main characters in this political race are so strong and in fact, are so insightful that most of the supporters are willing to go to any length to maintain the positions of their leaders and their parties. Kenyans have gone through this kind of cycle of violence in the past. It looks like the symptoms are there. The signs are there that if certain things don't happen right, it can trigger violence, and it doesn't take much. It's a little spark, and something terrible could happen. So many people are concerned about that.
That was VOA's Vincent McCourty speaking from Nairobi. Outrage against the nomination of Zimbabwe's president as a World Health Organization goodwill ambassador led to his swift removal from the post over the weekend. But the outrage appears strongest in his home country, where Robert Mugabe is largely blamed for ruining his nation's economy and health system during his 37 years in power. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg, with reporting contributed by Sebastian Mumfu in Harare.
Dr. Fortune Yamande said he could think of 4,000 reasons why President Robert Mugabe was a poor choice to be Goodwill Ambassador for the Global Health Body. 4,000, he says, is the number of Zimbabweans estimated to have been killed by cholera in 2008 and 2009. Cholera is widely seen as an indictment on modern healthcare systems, as the waterborne disease rarely causes deaths in developed nations. The state of Zimbabwe's healthcare system, says Nyamande, who leads the Zimbabwe Hospital Doctors Association, can be laid squarely at Mugabe's feet.
They have failed. In fact, they have put in place disastrous policies which have seen the collapse of our health sector from being one of the best health sectors in the world to into a sorry and miserable state. We still have a lot of people in our hospitals who are losing their lives because of lack of basic things, drugs, healthcare worker shortages, poor public healthcare funding, and quite a lot of other things.
Not that Mugabe has to endure this, says Dewa Mavinga, Southern Africa Director at Human Rights Watch, which also condemned last week's appointment.
Mugabe himself has been engaged in medical tourism, frequently flying to Singapore to seek medical attention, leaving behind in Zimbabwe a totally collapsed and useless health sector.
But Mugabe still has cheerleaders within his ZANU-PF party, who say the decision to rescind the post is a sign of international bias against Zimbabwe. Mugabe has claimed for years that Western powers are suffocating his nation with sanctions. Psychology Maziwiza is a member of parliament.
We saw that that was a befitting honor, and it is one that obviously was going to help in the advancement of that cause at an international level. But of course, they've had to rescind it for political reasons, which don't surprise us at all because, we're talking of the Western world here.
Opposition politician Douglas Bonzora disagrees.
Every right is thinking Zimbabwe on social media and in other modes of communication was condemning the appointment. And for them to say that it is the British and the Americans is simply to find a scapegoat. We, the Zimbabweans, didn't want it.
Zimbabwe's state-run Herald newspaper, long seen as a mouthpiece for the ruling party, has yet to weigh in on the issue. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Thirteen people have been killed by a suicide bombing in the northeastern Nigerian town of Maiduguri. There is some confusion as to what happened, with some reports quoting police and emergency officials as saying that a man strapped with explosives was responsible for the deaths yesterday evening and that two female suicide bombers wounded dozens. Other reports say the three attackers were all women. While there was no immediate claim of responsibility, extremist group Boko Haram is suspected. Militants from the group have long carried out suicide bombings, not only in northeastern Nigeria, but also in neighboring Niger, Chad, and Cameroon. In Liberia, the latest poll results for president guarantee a runoff on November 7th between the two top vote earners. Former football star George Weah and incumbent vice president Joseph Boakai. Weah has over 38% of the votes, about 10% more than his main challenger. No candidate passed the 50% threshold needed for an outright win. Many observers said there were some irregularities, but not enough to put the elections in doubt. Reporter Monique Joan has been following the campaign. VOA's William Eagle asked her how potential voters perceive the two leading candidates.
So for Joseph Boakai, the standard bearer for the Unity Party and the current vice president, you have Liberians who are skeptical of Boakai because they consider him to be a continuation of this relief administration and the frustrations they've had with their quality of life when Ellen Johnson Sirleaf was president, despite the fact that Boakai has tried to distance himself from Sirleaf during his campaign. He's also mocked for not being lucid and energetic enough to hold presidential office given his old age and his tendency to fall asleep during public events. Supporters back him, however, because they believe his vice presidential experience has made him the more prepared candidate for the role, and they echo his argument that he'll have more opportunity to show his leadership skills and even be more effective than Sirleaf if he's given greater authority as president than his previous more decorative position as vice president.
What about George Weah, who came in first place but still under 50% of the vote?
George Weah, on the other hand, from his party, the Congress for Democratic Change, is wildly popular here across ages and genders because of his legendary career as an international soccer star. And he first ran as president back in 2005 against Sirleaf. Even back then, he had garnered more votes than Sirleaf in the first round, but ultimately lost in the runoff. And in 2011, he ran as a vice presidential candidate with the same party, the CDC. But that, of course, was also unsuccessful because the Unity Party stayed in office. Weah later on, however, was elected as a senator for Monserrato County in 2014, the county in which the country's capital of Monrovia is located. So that government experience has helped give Weah even more credibility among voters who are already big fans of his soccer career. A lot of these voters really like the fact that he's a non-traditional candidate. He grew up in the slums of Liberia, and he isn't as highly educated or as experienced in government and corporate sectors as a more typical politician. So his supporters really find him relatable. Plus, people are really already disappointed with what politicians who have those more elite traditional backgrounds have accomplished. They feel that those more traditional politicians haven't actually done much anyway. So these voters who support Weah are even more willing to give more unconventional politicians a chance.
Have any of the remaining candidates declared their support for either of the two front runners?
So the conversation around which parties the remaining defeated candidates will support now is largely muddled because the other top contenders have come out challenging the results. One person from Charles Brumskine's party tells me that Brumskine, another candidate who has run for president three times now, is filing a complaint to the NEC because of the problems that occurred at the polling stations back on October 10th, Election Day. Some polling stations opened very late in the day because they had yet to receive their polling materials. Some voters didn't fill out their ballots properly. Some were placed in the wrong lines for their district. Others didn't have their name listed on the registry, even though they had their voter ID cards. So that prevented them from casting a ballot. Benoni Uri, the All-Liberian Party candidate and the founder of Lone Star, has also filed a complaint with the NEC, and his party is challenging the integrity of this year's election process. Alex Cummings, the Coca-Cola executive who ran with his party, the Alternative National Congress, held a press conference also challenging the integrity of the process. At the conference, Cummings said that he hasn't reached any sponsorship deals yet with either the Unity Party, as in Boakai's party, or the CDC, Weah's party. So Cummings has said that the ANC, his own party, hasn't reached a decision on which candidate it would ultimately support in the runoff. He did, however, concede that both Boakai and Weah's teams have reached out to him asking for his support.
That was Monique Joan in Monrovia. She was speaking with reporter William Eagle. 19 past the hour, you were listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Malawi has seen a surge in mob violence amid rumors of vampires. At least 9 people have been stoned to death since the start of September, and police have arrested 140 people accused of taking part in vigilante justice. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre.
On October 19th, an angry mob in Blantyre stoned to death 22-year-old epileptic man suspected of being a ritual bloodsucker. The vigilantes also stoned to death another person in a separate incident the same day. Residents report nocturnal visits by the alleged vampires. Ida Chikopa told her story directly to President Peter Mutharika when he visited her area. She said it happened to me on 19th September when I was asleep around 8 o'clock in the evening. I was surprised to see blood coming from my nose and blood was all over my mat. I asked my husband to light a torch to see what was happening. He went outside the house but could not see and find anything. But I was very weak that night. The president asked her to clarify, but Chikopa repeated the same statement. Police and medics say the rumors are a hoax. Lex Tenikachama is the Inspector General of the Malawi Police Service.
You can have some nose bleeding. In Chichewa, we call it Nkafuno. If you get that Nkafuno, you quickly rush to a decision that, you know, somebody, a black sucker, came and started sucking me blood. That is not true.
The rumors started in early September and have spread to 7 districts of the country. Residents told VOA they believe the bloodsuckers use modern technology and magic to immobilize victims late at night with a chemical, then drain their blood before vanishing. Government authorities are yet to establish the origin of the rumors, but residents believe they came from neighboring Mozambique. Kalepa Mawele is the chairperson for Palombe District Council. He says here in Palombe we have bordered Mozambique. We started hearing about rumors of bloodsuckers from Mozambique, and now they have spread in all areas of 6 traditional authorities here in Palombe. Some critics have tied the rumors to the recent nullification of vagrancy laws that prevented people from loitering on the streets at night. Most of those killed in the mob attacks were strangers to the area they were attacked. But the executive director for Center for Human Rights Education, Victor Muhango, disagrees with that premise.
I think we are primitive society. I think they believe in juju, that we just believe that this is happening. The police have challenged the nation that if you have evidence, show us. We are going to arrest them. People are just creating that. Maybe they have got some other motives.
In the meantime, UN agencies have withdrawn their workers from affected districts, and the U.S. Embassy has temporarily pulled out Peace Corps volunteers. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre, Malawi.
Compared with the developed West and the juggernauts of China, India, Bangladesh, and other Asian countries, sub-Saharan Africa is not a major manufacturing center. That has implications for the continent's vast numbers of unemployed young adults. The Center for Global Development, a Washington, D.C. research institute, has just completed a study that explores why Africa's manufacturing sector continues to lag behind and whether Africa might become an attractive place for investors to build factories. VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with CGD economist Vijay Ramachandran, the study's lead author. She began by addressing the youth job issue head on.
We are very aware that there are going to be a lot of young people in sub-Saharan Africa who are looking for jobs. In the coming decades, there's going to be another 100 to 200 million people entering the labor force. And given that that is the case, we wanted to try to understand if sub-Saharan Africa can become a destination for investors who are facing, you know, rising costs in China and Southeast Asia? That was the question that motivated us.
I understand, though, that your study shows that the actual cost of wages in Africa is actually high relative to some of these places like Bangladesh, where manufacturing already exists.
That's right, Adam. We find that the costs are quite high in many countries in Africa. Bangladesh, which we used as our benchmark because it does have so much manufacturing, has labor costs per worker of about $800 a year. And many countries in Africa are two or three times as high.
What is the reason for that? I mean, if there's such a need for jobs, why are labor costs so high? And on the other hand, you don't want to promote manufacturing practices and wages that are substandard just so that shareholders can be more satisfied. But if they're not satisfied, then Africa doesn't get the business. So it's kind of a vicious circle.
It is. It's a very difficult problem to tackle. But why are costs so high? I think in large part, it's driven by other very high costs in many African countries. So housing costs are very high. Food prices are high in many countries. Many big cities in Africa import a large fraction of the food they consume. And so I think there are things that governments can do to make the environment more attractive for manufacturers. If food prices are lower, you know, food becomes cheaper or housing becomes cheaper or the transportation infrastructure is improved. These are all things I think that will lower costs for manufacturers. So even though the levels of income are roughly similar between the poorer African countries and Bangladesh, the costs are a lot higher.
I noticed that among the countries you looked at in Africa, that Ethiopia comes out on top in terms of an attractive place for manufacturers to consider setting up plants and factories and so forth.
Yes, that's correct. Ethiopia looks like a very attractive destination for manufacturers, particularly, I think, those moving over from Asia. There are some big manufacturers who have recently located in Ethiopia, including H&M, a big Chinese company called Hujian International. These are companies that are coming in and setting up. So it is the case that some countries, at least in sub-Saharan Africa, are attractive destinations. But I want to make another point, which is that, you know, if wage levels are higher and that these countries are not particularly attractive in manufacturing, they may well be attractive to other sectors. It's not like their only option is manufacturing. It may be that, you know, for many countries in Africa, the services and service sector is much more viable option where they can engage in other types of activities than manufacturing.
Such as what? I'm especially thinking of young people now.
In particular, we're thinking of things like tourism and back office operations and other kinds of activities that are delivering services to people. So not everybody has to grow through manufacturing. You know, it is the case that that's how China developed and that's how much of Southeast Asia became wealthy. But it may be that Africa takes a completely different route, and it may be that the potential for services is very high. And in particular, I think there is enormous untapped potential for tourism.
That was The Economist, Vijay Rumachundarun of the Center for Global Development. Rumachundarun is the lead author of a new report about prospects for African manufacturing. She spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips in New York. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the sunny side of sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Werkinger, and our engineer, Wagner Roberts, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa. On the next Straight Talk Africa, a look at Kenya's opposition protest and election confusion as the nation prepares for a repeat presidential vote. Citing irregularities, Kenya's Supreme Court nullified the results of the August 8th presidential poll. Understanding Kenya's presidential election on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Hello, sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports.
I love Sunny Side of Sports.
Please join us for a whole half hour of sports talk and news Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC GMT. On the internet, you can like me on Facebook, follow me on Twitter, and read my blog. Visit voaafrica.com and enjoy the show.